who are sort of those left, but Caroline, although she's 6 and a half, she's eight, you know, she's a real smart girl.
Yes.
And, you know, she is aware.
Yeah.
She's very quiet.
He probably, as he gets older, will become more and more aware.
Oh, he will, definitely, you know.
Well, could we sit over here? This is
fine.
Most informal of the, this is on now, and what we're doing is just, we spoke to Mrs. Lincoln, who's just so wonderful.
How's
and
that about?
She was fine, and Mr. Schlesinger, Mr. Sorensen, and this is just JFK, a personal memory.
Yeah.
And
just a thought I had, I saw this gentleman looking, see that picture was taken in Dublin, and showing what a great sense of humor President Kennedy had, he said he did.
I'm in this car with these are all our agents and some of the Irish, these three, Kilpatrick, Sullivan, and Muldoon. And the president's here, and he put down homecoming for Day Powers from his traveling companion, John F. Kennedy.
Well, I mean, this is exactly the kind of thing I want to ask you. I don't know whether I should ask questions or just ask you to talk about him. Whichever you like.
Well, I first met him in 1946 when he was a candidate for a vacant seat in the House of Representatives in Massachusetts. It was the 11th Congressional District. James Michael Curley had been the congressman from 44 to 46, and when he was elected to mayor of Boston in 1945, he did not choose to run for Congress in 46. And President Kennedy and a field of nine others ran for that office. I had just returned from the China-Burma-India Theater, and it was January 1946 when a knock came on my door in Charlestown, Massachusetts. And when I answered the door, I saw this tall, thin, handsome fellow. He put out his hand and said, "I'm Jack Kennedy, and I am a candidate for Congress. Will you help me?" And he came in and sat down, and we discussed the type of district it was. It was a three-decker Irish district, and most of the men earned their living as longshoremen and freight handlers, truck drivers, and a laboring group, but a great, you know, God-fearing group of people that if they were with you all the way. And the next morning, he was speaking to a group of Gold Star mothers in Charlestown and asked me if I'd go down and hear him talk. So I met him at the Hotel Bellevue where he was staying at his grandfather's suite. And we came down, he said, "Will we take a taxi?" And I said, "No, why don't we ride the elevator in Boston for 15 cents? You can ride across the bridge into Charlestown." We rode over and we talked about the district. We rode over the Navy Yard and showed him where all the longshoremen worked. And he said, "I ought to go down and talk to them someday." And he had already started to plan his campaign. Well, he went over to Charlestown. He started, there were several hundred mothers in this hall, and he started to talk to them. And although he was no James Michael Curley, he had an honest, sincere delivery. But like all beginners, he had difficulty in bringing the speech to an end. And he looked out at them, thought a bit, and then from the heart said, "I think I know how you all feel because my mother is a Gold Star mother too. And I've never seen a reaction like it. All the mothers are standing around him at the platform, and I am outside the circle, and I can hear such comment as, 'He reminds me of my own Joe or Bill or Mike or Pat.'" And already he had established something in common with these Bunker Hill mothers in Charlestown. But in the history of American politics, I don't believe there is any man that ever worked as hard or made as many sacrifices to become president as John F. Kennedy. That in that district, there wasn't any day that he had not started shaking hands by 9 in the morning. He'd come over to Charlestown 2 days a week. He had divided the district up. We had three wards in Boston. East Boston was Ward 1, Charlestown was Ward 2, and the North End, as we called it, and parts of the West End and South End were in Ward 3. The district also took in Ward 22 in Brighton, all of Cambridge, and three wards in Somerville. He divided it with leaders in the entire district, and his political philosophy even then was, well, what would be good for Charlestown might not necessarily work in Somerville. And we started a registration drive. Thousands of boys had gone into the service at the age of 17, 18, and 19, and now they were home at the age of 21, 22, 23, and eligible to vote. So we had I had charge of the registration of all eligible voters, and we notified them where, when, and how, but also in the notification, we had a copy of John Hersey's story called Survival, which was written about the president's exploit in the Solomons and his miraculous rescue, and sort of a campaign vote for a veteran, a combat veteran like yourself, vote John F. Kennedy. And as you know, the president received 42% of the total vote cast and has never ever lost an election since where his name appeared on the ballot. 48, he was unopposed. 50, he was unopposed. In 1952, he selected to run against Senator Henry Cabot Lodge. And in a contest where President Eisenhower defeated Stevenson by 200,800 votes, John F. Kennedy defeated Henry Cabot Lodge by 70,737. And he did it mainly hard work. There was not a Friday, Saturday, or Sunday that the then congressman did not return to the district and campaign in a different part of Massachusetts. There was no place too small or too far away for him to work in.
What would you say his outstanding quality was? What did he project?
Actually, if to meet him was to like him, and to know him was one to help. He projected, he gave everyone that ever met him confidence that he had the ability to do the job. He made you feel immediately that he knew what was best for the district, or the state, or the country. He knew the wants and needs of the people.
Pardon me?
Yes, no,
I was wondering, how did he view the presidency?
Well, the president was great for comparing. And when he almost was nominated for vice president, although he had done less than 24 hours work, then he realized that if I work for 4 years, I can be president. And as you know, no one ever worked harder. That your toughest fight is a primary fight. I can remember being with him in Wisconsin, where we had the president's convoy, the Caroline, and the entire program, our schedule was set up for flying. And we ran into snowstorms and windstorms and blizzards off the lakes, and we had to campaign by car. And it meant starting as early as 5 in the morning and finishing as late as 2. At one occasion, the president and Ken O'Donnell and I are in a, we get in, he got to bed at 2:30 in the morning, and Ken O'Donnell and I are going over the schedule for the next day when Ken said, oh my God, he's supposed to get up at 6 in the morning. And he'd shake hands outside the gates of a huge plant. And this particular one, if he arrived there by 6 and stayed there until 9, he would have the opportunity of shaking approximately 2,000 hands. Well, I agreed to walk through the bedroom around 5:30. And if he awakened, I would tell him what was in store for the day. It's exactly what happened. As I walked through, the president, you know, who could go to sleep at any time, also would wake up with any type of noise. As I walked in, he said, who is it? And I said, it's Dave Powers. He said, what time is it? I said, 5:30. He said, what are you doing here? And as I'm telling him about the day schedule. He's already getting dressed, and I heard him say, "What are we waiting for?" Well, in the darkness, he's standing beside a clock where they're punching in, and Ken O'Donnell and I are passing out literature and buttons, and you can hear him saying over and over again, "I am Senator John F. Kennedy, candidate for president," over and over. And we don't see him until about the first hour and a half we could hear him and not seeing. And now, as it brightened up, the next hour and a half, we could both see him and hear him. And at 9 o'clock, when all the workers had gone in, we walk across the street. It was a combination tavern and place for a coffee and a sandwich. And we're three of us are drinking coffee out of a paper cup. And I notice the president's hand, his right hand, is swollen and blue and bloody, where in the darkness he wasn't catching a full hand. He was catching a fingernail here and there. And I can always remember him picking up the paper cup and saying, "This is pretty good coffee, isn't it?"
Of course, we know his hard work always continued. But as a human being, did he change much in the years and the way?
No, he got greater. One time, Bob Healy, he's a writer for the Boston Globe and a good friend of ours and a friend of all of the Boston Irish Mafia here. He heard me calling President Kennedy Mr. President. And he said, "God, Dave, you have known him since 1946 and you still call him Mr. President." And I said, "Bob, every time I see him, he looks more like Mr. President than the day before." That I never, ever, I'd walk into that office every day and he seemed to grow taller.
I think he did to the whole country. We spoke, Mr. Sorensen had a very interesting statement. I'm trying to tie all these interviews together so we can. He said that the president took issues terribly seriously but didn't take himself too seriously.
Now, I always remember the president was always at his best when things were darkest. Going back at the time that he was going on television to explain to the American people the our position in Berlin in relation to the wall. And then later, when the Russians had dropped the highest megaton ever. And then later, during the eyeball-to-eyeball crisis in Cuba. I always thought that Newt Rockne probably had a man like President Kennedy in mind when he once said, "When the going gets tough, the tough get going," because President Kennedy was always at his best when he had to. And I can remember on all of these occasions, I'd go up and have dinner with him at 7:30. And in the darkest hour, you could always find him at 7:30 reading Caroline a bedtime story. And then he had a way of separating the business on hand from his family. He had his private life and his political life, and he worked that way with friends too, that sort of had a way of fitting everyone in and everything in so that one never blocked another or interfered with another.
You were the one who found him when the Russians exploded the 58 megaton bomb.
Yes, I walked into the. I had picked up the news and Mac Bundy had sent over. They had picked it up and Mac Bundy had sent the news over. And now I picked it up on the radio, coming in, and I get off the elevator at 7:30, and there he is reading Caroline a bedtime story.
What did he say when you told him?
The president, he just wondered why everyone didn't know him as well as he knew himself. I think if the president looked for, among other things, and maybe more than other things in people, courage and loyalty. He had great respect and like men like Douglas MacArthur, and the astronauts, and you know, men that could do things, and great athletes, and like often when we'd swim together, he'd, you know, talk about Stan Musial or Ted Williams, or he'd be amazed at Y.A. Tittle being as great as he is at this age, and he just sort of compared himself. You could see him, if he were not president, as a quarterback fading back to pass, or a golfer under pressure, or a baseball player in that. Anything that was a challenge. I remember a quote that he always remembered about MacArthur. And when General MacArthur was here last year to talk to the president, the President Kennedy mentioned a quote when Douglas MacArthur received one of his Distinguished Service Cross citations. It must have been in World War I. And quote, "On a field where courage was the rule, his courage was the dominant feature." And when during his trip to Ireland, when he talked about the Irish Brigade and to the Irish, and he reminded some of them that might have forgotten the heroics of the famed Irish Brigade at Gettysburg and in other Civil War battles, and he used that quote, "War-battered dogs are we, gnawing a naked bone, fighting in every land and clime for every cause but our own."
You're answering all the questions before I ask them.
You're just wonderful.
Do you have a few more minutes?
All right.
Can you talk? Would you talk a little bit about the children? The way he was with them.
The president was marvelous with his children, and I used to be envious of him sometimes because he saw more of his children than he would have if he were not president. That Caroline, when he first moved in, Caroline used to walk to work with him every day before preschool. And then later, in the last 6 months, John used to walk to work with him every day. And then it would not be uncommon after a McCoyan or some group would be in at a meeting that would run like from 11 to 12, or after a cabinet meeting, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, for the President to open the back door of his office, clap his hands, and have Caroline and John come running. And we used to swim every day, and then after the swim, the President would go up and have lunch, and again he'd be with Caroline and John. And in the evening, he'd read Caroline a bedtime story before he said goodnight to her. And now, in the last 6 months, at Squaw Island, he used to do, and at Cape Cod, he used to do the same for John. So the president was very, very close to his children, and I think he used to look at John. John is a marvelous build for 3 years old, and see a great athlete. And in Caroline, a great lady like her mother.
Were you with him his first day in the White House?
Yes.
Could you tell us how?
Well, the first day, the office seemed sort of big for him. He was used to having people closer to him, and he'd be pressing buttons on his desk, and he'd press one, and Evelyn Lincoln would come in a side door, and he'd go, "Oh, is that where you are?" And then he'd press another, and Ken O'Donnell would come running, and I was out at the reception desk then, and finally around 10:30 he got to that button, and right away the boys working for me, Mitch and Tom and Roger, got all excited. It says, "The president." And as I started in, he started out. And by noon that day, he knew where everyone's office was. He just couldn't wait for them to come in. He went after them. And he walked around upstairs and downstairs until he knew where everybody's office was. And then he'd talk to them on the phone and ask them how they liked being there.
How do you like to remember him most? Is there any particular scene that comes to mind?
No, I like to, everything about him, is remembered in greatness. You know, I always think of his courage and his greatness. He never complained. You sort of sometimes might have an idea by some of his silence that maybe his back was bothering him, but he never, ever complained. He hated, disliked maybe someone that might whimper about something like that. You know, he used to like people that were willing to stand up and be counted. But he never complained, and it was great about him. And he never stopped working. The president tried to use up every minute of every day. Even at mealtime, he'd be reading or writing. And even in the pool, a thought would come to him, the swimming would relax him, and he'd say, Dave, would you tell Ken O'Donnell I want to see, and he'd mention someone that he wanted to see at, say, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock. And his day was never done. He'd take all the papers over to the room with him and try to be as prepared as you possibly could be for tomorrow's meetings. And after a while, he knew more about what was going on than anyone there.
Last question, what was the happiest moment? Is there one?
Well, when you're with him, you never thought of anything that wasn't happy, as I say, except that long ride home from Texas, because everything about him was great. And I've been happy since I first met him in 1946. I used to have a rule when some newspaper man used to want to write a little story about me, and I used to say, you can write it if somewhere in the story you say, anyone can do what I'm doing, I'm only lucky the president likes the way I'm doing it. And that's the way it was, that he was so great to work with.
For the purposes of the tape, would you introduce yourself?
This is David F. Powers, presidential assistant.
And what could you describe in a couple of sentences your general function?
My job was to keep the president on time.
Good. We can go on for hours, obviously. Yeah. Are you doing a book?
No. Actually, Bob, we joke about people doing books. We say that if everyone that writes a book buys a book from the other fellow that wrote them, they'll all be bestsellers.
Yeah, the whole thing is, these memories are gone. They don't last forever.
No, but nothing lasts forever.
Yeah.
The president loved it. Actually, he had a lot on the Irish trip. He was going into Dublin. Going into Dublin.
No, we didn't. We got Mrs. Lincoln told us about Berlin.
Dublin was, I'd say, that nothing else. That's really talked about that night. Actually, it was June 26, 1963. During the drive into Dublin with De Valera, who sat in the car, President Kennedy stood and waved to the tremendous crowd. As he rode, he could see his picture in every store window with the Gaelic words, what do they say, Cead meal faulty? Cade meal faulty. It means 100,000 welcomes. All of Dublin's 500,000 citizens waved, jumped, and shouted to the president as he drove to the American embassy. All President Kennedy talked about during our first night in Ireland was the fabulous, open-hearted Dublin welcome. He had smiled and waved through an hour's journey, through a continuous corridor of happy faces, through streets of flag-waving thousands. It seemed that every man, woman, and child had gathered in the streets to welcome him. I traveled with the motorcade which left the airport at 8:15, about 25 minutes after the president's jet touched down. After the short speeches from both presidents, the cheers started. The echoes surged through the Dublin air, heralding the motorcade to the waiting, eager crowds. From my car, directly behind the presidential car, I had a full view of the entire route. I have never seen such a greeting in all my life. Irish troops stiffened to attention, while others who were not part of the ceremonial guard waved their hats from parked trucks. People who had waited quietly for hours suddenly gave vent to their feelings with shouts of, "Welcome back, Jack."
Thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome.
Pleasure meeting you, Mr. Powers.
What's going to be used overseas?
Yeah, we'll get you a copy of the show because I think you might like to have it. And I'd love to call you about maybe working on a book.
The thing actually, I have a souvenir I'll give you people, a mascara. I'll get some. Do you ever get one of these?
Oh, lovely, lovely.
I'll get
wonderful.
Some of the girls. I think we have one that's smiling.